KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Fairchild is the Spokane area's single largest employer with 5,800 workers and an economic impact of $1.3 billion a year. A special session in Olympia is now underway. It'll last 30 days. The main focus is the budget. There isn't one for Washington yet, and after 2 weeks off to negotiate, KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins says there's still no budget deal in sight.
Senate Budget Chair Andy Hill, a Republican, says both sides are working in good faith, but that true negotiations have yet to begin. And that's because the House, Senate, and governor are still working to agree on the basic assumptions for the next two-year budget. Once that happens, Hill says a deal could come together pretty quickly, but there's still a major roadblock, a dispute between the two chambers over whether to close some tax exemptions and extend an expiring tax. Lieutenant Governor Brad Owen, a Democrat, presides over the Senate. He believes the Senate leadership will ultimately have to let some of its members join with minority Democrats to vote for taxes.
At some point, you have to say, you know, what's in the best interest of the state moving forward, and release the members to do what they need to do to get us out of there, which means you'll have crossover.
Owen spoke with me on TVW's Inside Olympia program. Senator Hill, the Republican budget chair, responds that there are creative ways to bridge the gaps that don't involve defaulting to taxes. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
. 58 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Expecting showers today, maybe a little thunder this afternoon, and a high of 61. Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at ZurichNA.com. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:06.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. You're listening to some music from a trio called The Onlys. They're three Garfield High School freshmen. One of them just turned 15 yesterday. The other two, 14 years old. They've been playing together at Bernard for 10 years. It's amazing. We're going to hear a live studio performance from The Onlys later this hour. We're also going to take a look at the factors that lead to a good death. That conversation is coming up in about 15 minutes. After a two-week hiatus, the Washington State Legislature is back in session in Olympia. When the regular session ended on April 28th, most of the major work was undone. Jerry Kornfield covers state politics for the Everett Herald. We've been talking to him this winter and spring, and he's with us again today to talk about the week or weeks ahead in Olympia. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
So I understand that they got back together about an hour ago officially, right?
Well, a few of them, yeah, they're trailing in here kind of slowly. They're down in here in Olympia, they have something called pro forma sessions, which means you don't have to be there. There'll be others in charge who'll bang the gavel and say, "We're here." The actual formal votes and action are still to come. Around 1 o'clock today, the Senate's going to go in and they'll pass a couple of things that say, well, let's get started. But that's all they're really here for today, is to look each other in the eye, meet in their caucuses, and kind of hear from their leaders sort of what we've been saying, what Austin was saying a few minutes ago, that, you know, here's where we're at, here's what we did, budget negotiations over the last 2 weeks, and here's what the next 30 days look like, in our opinion. And so they kind of touch base in their conversations about what they're going to do in the House and Senate and each caucus.
Did you expect more work to be done on the budget in the past 2 weeks?
The budget is a strange animal. It's a puzzle with a ton of pieces. And one of the problems was they each did a puzzle with different size pieces, and so they were trying to figure out, each side with the House and the Senate were looking at each other going, okay, well, how did you come up with that piece? And then the other side would say, well, how did you come up with that piece? So over the last 2 weeks, I think they did accomplish a lot in at least understanding the logic of each other's budget. Now they can sit down and they can kind of argue on the same page about why the assumptions in each other's budgets are good ones or bad ones, and why they say, you know what, you convinced us, we'll take this piece. How about if we convince you to take this piece? So, they didn't have as many face-to-face meetings, but I think they got some of the really difficult work done, and that is sort of agreeing on how each side came up with their budgets.
Well, the legislature trickles in today, and the governor has been working. He didn't take 2 weeks off. What's high on his priority list for this special session?
Well, we'll find out a little more of what his plans are this first week. Today at 2:15, he's holding a news conference. But if I had to write up his sort of things to do list over the next 30 days, I think what he wants to accomplish is first, maybe this week, have the legislature pass, at least one of the chambers pass a bill dealing with impaired drivers. Mm-hmm. It's really targeting the repeat offenders of drunken driving. He's made that a priority, and that bill is in pretty good shape, at least so he thinks, so he'd like to see that happen. I think he'd like to see a handful of solid face-to-face meeting on the budget so that in this first week there might actually be some agreements on some big issues, and maybe by next week start to see all the pieces start to come together and both sides saying what they want to do and what they'll give up.
One other big thing that has to be done, as I understand it, aside from the budget, is some kind of education funding plan that is mandated by a state Supreme Court decision.
Right. And I think you're going to see that sort of in sort of a couple of pieces. One will be in the budget. You'll see dollars and cents going into programs, and each side will have to sort of agree. The Senate wants to put $1 billion in, the House wants to put $1 billion in, but they want to put it in different places. So I think you'll begin to see those numbers. At the same time, you're going to see a handful of policy bills dealing with what happens in the classroom, everything from can principals hire and not hire the teachers they want, and will third graders and fourth graders take more tests on reading, and if they don't pass them, will they be kept back? Some of those bills that did not make it through the legislative session are very important to Republicans in the Senate, so I think you'll see the policy bills. But they have to do all of that, and those may be the votes that come down in the final days of the session on those policy bills.
Is there an option for a second special session?
They can go as often as they want, as long as they want, as long as the governor calls them back.
Well, we've got to have something by July 1st, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the budget year starts July 1st, and they should have something in place, but they could pass something. The money continues to come in, even if there's not a piece of paper that says a budget. Taxes continue to be collected, bills get paid, and so there's enough money that will be coming in to run government on July 1st, on July 2nd. So they would need to pass a minimal document, something that says, let's just keep doing, kind of what Congress does with its continuing resolution. But that's a little long, that's a ways off. I think everyone believes they can get their work done in the next 30 days or maybe the next 35 days. If they're really close, the governor might have to call them back for a second special session right away.
Well, speaking of the governor, just another interesting thing. We had news in over the weekend that Boeing was going to send a bunch of tech jobs out of state. And I know that the governor has been on the stump for Boeing to make sure that the 777 construction is firmly headquartered here in Washington.
Yeah, that had to be kind of an awkward timing from his standpoint. I mean, he made a big deal up in Everett on Thursday about how Washington's in it to win it, and they're going to make a big push to get that 777 project that's just around the corner. I don't think that the shift of workers and the layoffs is totally sort of a shock to the Boeing system. But coming so close to the governor's announcement, one has to wonder whether he saw it coming and whether if Boeing gave him any indication, and if so, if that undermines his pitch, because he's fighting for one thing at the same time the company is willing to move employees out of the state. So I don't think he appreciated the timing.
And just real briefly, non-legislatively, candidates can start filing for city and county offices for the fall. And Ed Murray of the state Senate, a leader in the state Senate, is running for mayor of Seattle. Anybody else?
Well, I mean, he's part of a crowded field. And then we have down in the 26th legislative district, Derek Kilmer held the seat. He went to Congress. So Right now, State Senator Nathan Schlichter is going to try, and he'll have to run for that seat this fall. And State Representative Jan Angel, a Republican, is going to challenge him. And so that one is going to be closely watched and pretty high-priced campaign going into the fall.
Jerry Kornfield covers Washington state politics for the Everett Herald. He's been a regular guest on weekday during the legislative session, and we'll be talking to you through the special session. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Talk to you next week.
This is KUOW.
It's 10:15. What makes a good death? We're going to take that up in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from AEG Live, presenting the Marymore Park Concert Series with Rebel, Lucian, and Matisse Yahoo at King County's Marymore Park on August 14th. Tickets on sale Monday, May 13th at noon. More information at marymoreconcerts.com.
Cloudy sky over Seattle, 58 degrees. Expecting showers today, maybe some thunder this afternoon. And it's going to be breezy with a high of 61. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:16. The Onlys is a Seattle band comprised of three high school students. They play fiddle-driven music with Celtic, old-time American, and Canadian roots. And we're going to hear a conversation with them and some music in 20 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silming. What planning or health care or conversations with family lead up to a good death? Katie Sewell wanted to hear a doctor's perspective on that question. Hey, Katie.
Hey. And I found just the doctor to do it, Marcy. Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary and critical care doctor who has his fair share of good and bad deaths under his belt, watching them with different patients. He writes about the end-of-life issues at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. And I asked him, what makes a good death?
A good death would be where an individual's wishes are adhered to. This can mean different things for different people, depending on their cultural background, the extent of their disease, their fear of suffering, mental anguish, so many things. But the challenge to medical providers is to begin to understand where the patient is coming from. And the ethical principle around that is autonomy of patient being in charge with a full informed consent. And that's a little tricky at the end of life. How do you really show somebody what all the interventions we can do are, and how does that compute? I can go on with that if you'd like.
Feel free.
Okay. There's pretty good evidence when just a doctor is a talking head that the patient will walk out of an exam room or a class with a fairly small retention of what's really said. If you ask the doctor, he said, I covered every important point. But if a social worker or a nurse sits down with a patient and really tries to dissect what they understood, it can be only a certain amount and not really a full understanding. There's a very interesting physician at Harvard, Angelo Yolandis, who noticed this in his training there. He had a patient with a glioblastoma of the brain, which carries a pretty bad prognosis. And he talked to her about end-of-life issues. We could put you in the intensive care unit. There's a respirator. There's CPR. There's various interventions. And she said, well, she was struggling to understand what all those meant. And so he said, well, how about if I put you in a wheelchair and take you down to the intensive care unit? So when they went in, there was actually a crisis that occurred and a patient required CPR, and she was able to witness this. And when she got back and was able to talk to him, he found that this visual experience, kind of emotional visual experience, really changed her perspective. And she said, it's now clear to me I would never want something like that. So one of the things I do in my retirement years is present courses to people age 65 and above, but it's really appropriate for any age, and certainly with families involved too. It's called Your Life, Your Choices. And it's with this course, it lasts maybe an hour and a half. And I've presented it mostly within group health because that's where I work, but also in church groups and rotaries and that kind of thing, and tried to walk people through what are your values, what's important to you, you know, what are your biggest hopes or your biggest fears as you approach the end of life, and then what's really important in your near-term future. Do you want to keep going to see a granddaughter graduate from college or a marriage or a special anniversary? And once people can begin to articulate their values, then it's very important to write them down and communicate them. So a big piece of this is, first of all, thinking about your values, articulating them, and then writing them down. But getting back to the videos, it's been shown that if you use video very clear, very non-judgmental, very matter-of-fact, you don't mince words like cancer and death and that kind of thing, that people really like that. They begin to understand it. If you can see a visual of somebody actually getting chest compressions or having an endotracheal tube put down in their windpipe, then it becomes much more real. And where they've done comparative studies with one group that only gets oral instruction and another gets the video instruction, they find that patients much less frequently opt for the aggressive care. And that includes things like joint replacements and back surgery and other things as well.
One of my work colleagues, when we were discussing this earlier today, has a mother in hospice right now. Yes. And was talking about a booklet that he received that sort of walked him through, this is what's going to happen, then this. He said it was almost as if dying is as routine as learning how a child is born.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had any comments on that from witnessing so many people that have gone through this.
Each case is so individual. In fact, you shouldn't talk about cases. You should talk about their name or who they are. And each one is a journey. It's hard in a pamphlet because a pamphlet sounds so cold and so non-caring. And when you're in this environment, it's really important to be able to look people in their eye, hold their hand, comfort them. There's a wonderful TED video given by, I'm blocking on his name, Abraham Verghese, who's at Stanford and wrote a wonderful novel, Cutting for Stone. But he talks about the very important power of touch. So I think in the caring environment, it can sound very cold. You're on this pathway with no exit, you know, or one exit at the end. And in fact, there's a controversial pathway in England right now called the Liverpool pathway, which is a strategy, almost a protocol for the dying patient. And hospice, as you probably know, it's a wonderful program. It's Medicare, adds Medicare value if you're in your last 6 months of life. And some non-Medicare insurance programs offer hospice as well. But you get a 24-hour hotline to call. You get a nurse assigned to you. You get home visits, medications, durable medical equipment, spiritual care, things that you really need. You know, we've been so willing as a society to pay for major surgeries, bone marrow transplants and whatnot. But how about the day-to-day caregiving that people need? So hospice is a real step in the right direction there. And surgeon said, you know, dying without hospice would be like having surgery without anesthesia.
Interesting. I'm speaking with Jim DeMaine. He's a retired pulmonary critical care doctor, and he blogs about end-of-life issues at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. Where does fear fit into this?
Well, I think we all fear death. We all deny. Woody Allen said something like, I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. So I think denial and fear are both natural things. And it's something that we get no practice at. It only happens once. Critical illness usually only happens once. So I think it's cultural. I've seen some amazing acceptance and lack of fear of death. And I've seen some people terrified right up until the end. I can give you an example of a lady who was in my practice from Guam, and she had a terrible lung disease called pulmonary hypertension, where the lung arteries start to shut down, and that pressure backs up in the heart, and they just can't breathe and function. And normally they might need a lung transplant. Well, she was on oxygen and kind of doing okay, but gradually going downhill. And so I started to bring up the issue of lung transplant with her. And she said, oh, no, I would never want anything like that. I'm in the Lord's hands, and that's the way I look at it. I would never want anything like that. And so she was able to go to Guam on a visit, managed to get oxygen there and on the airplane, and sent me a postcard saying she was doing okay. And then came back, and once again I said, you know, you're really getting close to the end. Wouldn't you like to at least have more conversation, bring your husband in? And husband happened to be available. He came in, and he just kind of smiled and shook his head and said, that's what she wants. So she did transition into hospice care, which was based at home. And I kind of lost track, although the hospice nurses would send me notes as to how she was doing. But one day I got a call from the hospice nurse, would you please come in, because she would like to see you. And of course, I wanted to see her too. So after work, I stopped by. It was kind of a rainy evening, a nice house, well-groomed yard. And I go rap on the door, and I hear music inside and laughter. And I thought, oh, this is really interesting. What's going on? So I opened the door, and it was kind of like a festive occasion. And the living room was set up, and there was her hospital bed, middle of the living room. Food abounded all over the table, grandkids running around, people talking, people at her bedside. And this was their cultural way of dealing with death. They had accepted it. They were making it as pleasant as possible. The hospice nurses were giving her just enough morphine and sedatives to keep her shortness of breath under control, just titrating her symptoms. So I just sat down and held her hand and listened to her stethoscope. And she looked at me and said, Dr. DeMaine, you must be very tired. Please go get something to eat. So she was looking after me, which I thought was so sweet. So It was just a wonderful time for me as a caregiver to see somebody able to accept death like that.
What do you do when you encounter a patient that is incredibly fearful right up to the moment?
It's hard. You know, you like to, first of all, listen. You know, let them identify what their fears are, and then try to bring loved ones in with them. Sometimes it can be all over the place. It can be fear of suffering, shortness of breath, or pain. I had one patient who lived out in one of the islands. He would come in and see me periodically, and one day he invited me out to lunch. And I was kind of worried because he was a super salesman. I didn't know what he was going to try to sell me, but actually he was trying to sell me on the way he wanted to die, because he had horrible emphysema and he was so fearful of suffocating at death. And this was kind of in the era before hospice, because I've been in practice a long time. And so I said, well, there are things we can do. We can use sedatives and medication, but it might speed up your death by a matter of hours, or at least a short period of time. And he says, I don't care about that. I just don't want to suffer at the end. And ultimately, that's what happened. He talked with his sons. The family was on board. And when he came into the ER and I came in the evening and saw him, we did not put him in intensive care. We put him on a medical unit. There were very experienced nurses there, fortunately, who were on board. And we carried out that plan for him. And I got a beautiful note later. But some suffering is spiritual or psychological. There you may need some mental health help, some counseling. Social service can always help. Chaplains can help. You have to really listen and find out what's going on. I had one fellow who was at the end was having more and more problems, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, and he was still getting along okay. And I said, you know, you're lucky to be alive. And he looked at me and he burst into tears. And I said, what's going on? He said, you don't know how lucky I am. He had been a paratrooper at D-Day in World War II, and he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder that had never been treated. His family had always tried to get him in, but he would have these panic attacks. And as he was dying, these actually worsened. It was kind of sad because he never truly got treated for this, but it enabled us to know what was going on and to, you know, treat those with sedatives and other medications. So fear is all over the place.
You have to adapt to each person.
You do. Each one is so unique.
Jim DeMain is a retired pulmonary and critical care doctor. He's also emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of a hospital ethics committee, frequently giving talks to patients about planning for end-of-life issues. Maybe we should touch on briefly what a caregiver needs to know to help a good death happen.
Well,
I mean, a person not in the medical system, but a family member or a friend.
Right. There are, you know, pamphlets and books out for caregivers. I actually co-authored one locally. I don't know how widely it's used. But caregivers are very special people. And we need to pay attention to the caregiver because they're wearing out often. They're often suffering. They're going through grief and other things. So hospice focuses both on the caregiver and the patient. Of course, the patient's the central focus, but the caregiver, number one, needs to know what the wishes of the patient are so that they can try to adhere to that. And then also, you know, try to do as much physically as they can, but they need to also seek support of their community groups or religious groups, friends. Hospice helps with volunteers to come in because caregivers can wear out.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, if they do, then the total care picture begins to suffer.
What do you want for yourself after teaching all these classes and being a physician?
Well, one thing I attached to, it was actually a patient that brought in a value statement for me, and I attached it to his advance directive. And it basically said that, you know, if I'm in a position where my quality of life has suffered so that I'm no longer able to communicate effectively, understand what's going on, being a participant in daily life, that I really wouldn't want to be a burden on my family, physically or financially for that matter, and that I would want to be treated well in terms of just general attentiveness and whatnot, but that I wouldn't want life-prolonging care, particularly the ventilator with a tube in my throat, or CPR, because those life-prolonging measures are wonderful when there's a reversible process. But if you're at the end stage, those kinds of things can prolong death rather than prolong life.
Hmm.
So for myself, right now, if something happened, please call 911.
We'll do, we'll do.
If I'm at the end, you know, the course way of pulling it is stating it is to say pull the plug. But that sounds too abrupt and uncaring.
Mm-hmm. Jim DeMain is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He teaches patients about end-of-life issues, and you can read more of his writing at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Kitty.
That's music from the Seattle band The Onlys. We'll talk with them and hear more of their music in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support KUOW and your other favorite local nonprofits this Wednesday, May 15th, by participating in Give Big. Give Big is a community-wide day of giving hosted by the Seattle Foundation. A share of every contribution made will be matched by Give Big sponsors. For more information, go to kuow.org.
58 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach just 61 this afternoon. Forecast says expected to be cloudy and breezy with showers and maybe some thunder as well. Overnight, much the same, dropping down to 46. Tomorrow, Tuesday, partly sunny with a high in the mid-60s.
Support for KUOW comes from Smile Partners, offering preventive dental care to schools, refugees, and seniors in need. Participating in the Seattle Foundation's one-day Give Big campaign this Wednesday, May 15th. Online and on Facebook as smilepartners.org. Healthy smiles, healthy lives.
10:35. I'm Bernard Ouellette. This morning, President Obama spoke out on all the attention being given to the government's talking points in the wake of the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. Some people, including Senator John McCain, say what they've discovered amounts to a cover-up. The president says this whole debate is just a partisan sideshow. More in the news at 11.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. The annual Northwest Folklife Festival is coming up at the end of the month, and as always, it's a chance for you to hear traditional music from the many cultural groups that live here in the Pacific Northwest. We've got a wealth of talented musicians here, but it's not so often that you see a trio like the Onlys. Sammy Brayman, Leo Shannon, and Riley Calcagno are just finishing up their freshman year at Garfield High School. Even though none of them is old enough to have a driver's license, they've got a decade or so of performing experience under their belts. The Onlys join me in the KUOW Performance Studio today. We're going to open with a tune that they wrote. It's called Past the Fog.
One, two, three, four. Sit down and set off our secrets in fine black pen. Maybe someday we'll see them again. Close the book for now. I take the next train west. Sinking sun sets, the frozen air on fire. Nothing to do but run, run, run. Keep heading west, don't look back. I won't look back. And they say so that you can't see past the fog. Settling for the winter. Hop off the train, just north of Monterey. Stumble blindly down the coast. Don't hear any engines. Don't see any people. People are what I need the most. And they say settling for the winter.
someday you'll escape. Leave that bitter little town behind. We can go forward together, falling in and out of our minds. And they say that you'll never get out of that town. I'm running away. Sorry, I can't stay. So squint to look away, so that you can't see past the fog. Settling for the winter.
That's the Onlys performing live in the KUOW Performance Studio. On fiddle, Sammy Brayman. On guitar, Leo Shannon, Riley Calcagno. Playing mandolin, and they all three wrote this. They're putting their instruments down just a second, so you hear a little rustle there. You play a mix of tunes that you write and traditional music, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, we started like playing traditional fiddle music and all that kind of stuff, and then eventually, like, Leo and I think started listening to, you know, rock music. Like, Leo went through a death metal phase, and, as everybody does. And eventually got into some more
indie
music.
It was quite a few years ago, by the way.
there aren't that many years to have, Leo. So, wait, so you started off with the sort of traditional folk string tune music. Are your parents musicians?
Yeah. All of them play, at least one of our parents plays some sort of instrumental sound.
And we've all, I've always listened to, along with the radio songs, I've listened to, like, folk music, and, like, my parents have always had a love for that, and so I've kind of grown up with it.
How long have you three been playing together as the Onlys?
Since we were about 7, so we all started when we were 4, 5, and 6, and then we had known each other from before, and we kind of inspired each other to start playing too.
Yeah.
And I think some of the first times we played together were busking at Folklife when we were really little.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think we probably made more money then than we do now.
I know. We busked a couple times at Folklife last year, and it's definitely not as much. We're kind of starting to lose the cute factor, maybe, of being
14
little
is not
fiddler.
The same
for yourself.
We're talking with the Onlys in the KUW Performance Studio. Where does that name come from, by the way?
We're all only children.
Yeah, that's one of the motivations behind it. We used to have a really bad name.
What was that bad name?
it was Beach 3. Which had no, we
it
actually
had no purpose.
Yeah,
we saw a painting, or there was a series of paintings at a wine bar in Columbia City.
I have no idea who that artist was, but shout out.
They were just beach picture paintings of beaches, and
they were really artsy, as you can imagine.
Some very creative titles like Beach 1, Beach 2, and Beach 3.
Yeah.
And Riley looked at it and said, "How about Beach 3? Because we were thinking of band names, and we were like, okay, that's good.
That was when we were like 7. And then.
And how long did that name last?
I mean, it started us off, like, we started getting more, like, gigs with that. Like, we played Folklife 1 year under that name, but mm-hmm. we decided that we wanted a name that had purpose to us.
Yeah, and a more adult name to kind of grow with us. And
so you can always be the Onlys.
Yeah.
You have a new album. It's called Setting Out to Sea. You have an EP, but I think this is your first full-length album.
Yeah, it is.
And it's a mix of tunes that you've written and very traditional music.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're mixed up together in the same cut, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So what are you looking for musically? What attracts you to a tune? Is it the style? Is it the sound?
Well, Leo, Riley, and I all have... We started out having very, like, we each, like, I have always loved music from Cape Breton in Scotland, kind of, like, because I saw it when I was, like, when I first started playing, I, like, did all, like, the beginning stuff, but then I saw a Natalie McMaster concert, and I was like, whoa, and I, like, absolutely fell in love with that kind of music, and so, like, that was always, like, one thing that that's, like, the basis for, like,
so that's your inspiration.
Mine. And
yeah, and then I started with classical music originally, then fell in love with Irish fiddle music, and just a year or two ago, I started playing old-time music, too, because Riley plays old-time music as well, and I fell in love with that, and so I try to keep both of those styles kind of going.
And what about the death metal part?
That fell away, unfortunately.
That was almost like a fifth-grade love. Like, Leo is always ahead of us. Like, I feel like he's already...
Riley's just getting into his death metal phase.
Yeah.
Death metal on the mandolin. Well, what about you, Riley?
I started with classical music, and I continue to do that. But my dad has always been a great, really, really into old-time music. So I started with that, and I love all kinds of fiddle music, really. Like anything that makes good sound to me, that I enjoy listening to, I'm a fan of.
So I mentioned when I introduced you that all three of you are about to be sophomores at Garfield High School. I'm sure you're all going to pass your classes and make it into 10th grade.
And you're
involved in music in school as well as career as the only. So, Leo, you told me before we turned on the recorder, you're a jazz band.
I play guitar in the jazz band. And at the end of the summer, I'm in the freshman band or the C band, but hopefully next year I can get into B or A, which would be nice. And the A band is in New York right now.
Essentially Ellington, Sammy, and Riley, that's where you continue your classical.
I continued classical, and so I'm in the orchestra at Garfield under Sudakawa, and I recently started playing with the A orchestra, which is the older kids.
Violin?
Yeah, violin, and I don't play mandolin in the orchestra. I think that'd be inappropriate. But I'm all the way in the back in my little chair, being scared of the upperclassmen.
No, you have a lot of performance experience. I don't know why. And Sammy, you're playing in the freshman orchestra.
Yeah,
this year.
I'm in the freshman orchestra, and I just auditioned to be in the A orchestra or A or B orchestra, like Riley or like Leo last week. And so I'm hoping that I'll do well.
How do these musical worlds overlap with your own band, or don't they? Do you have influences from the jazz or classical?
I think definitely, like...
Yeah, like, I was, me and Riley went, I guess Sammy too, we went to a Portland old-time gathering, and I was noticing that playing rhythm guitar in the jazz band had helped my old-time guitar playing, and even though they're pretty different styles, it was really cool to see the overlap.
And, I mean, we're really all into... When we kind of all approached this out-of-town scene by going to... fiddle camps such as like Valley of the Moon in California and things like that. And we met people like Daryl Anger and the Claridges. They have like more jazzy influences, and so we were inspired by them. So we kind of all, and also classical influences. So I think really music is just music, and as long as it's a cool thing that sounds good to you and you love doing,
the musical director at this thing we did called More Music at the Moor. Michelle Indigicello, we got a chance to work with her for a week, and she emphasized the fact that she doesn't believe in genres of music. She thinks that it's like overlapping, and I really like that because I've always classical music's like new to me, but I know that it's definitely benefited my fiddle playing a lot. So.
We're talking with Sammy Brayman, Riley Calcagno, and Leo Shannon, and Leo has the lower voice, Sammy has the highest voice, and Riley's right there in the middle. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the collective songwriting that you do. I know on the album there are some that are credited just to Leo, I think.
Yeah, but, so the first, that one, That Old Place, I wrote by myself, but our first song that we've ever played together was written, lyrics were written by me and Riley.
In science class.
Yeah. Sorry, too little.
Exactly. And then the title track of the CD, I wrote that one pretty much by myself.
Yeah, so we've kind of developed into like writing, it's just easier to write by yourself. And like I wrote that one that we just played, and then...
Pass the Fog?
Yeah.
Pass, like pass a tray, but in the past, ago.
Yeah.
Do you bring it together then to rehearsal?
And yeah.
Do they have veto power? Do you ever...
Yeah,
does he write something?
I just hate my songs.
we've only done like a couple of... No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I think if it feels like the onlys, then we do it. And I think
we have all pretty good judgment of what our sound is and what... When I like write some kind of Justin Bieber-y pop song, we're not gonna do that one. That Justin Bieber isn't a fantastic musician. We don't need to go there.
Right. But do you write that kind of music? No.
Not really. But
well, you guys have written some like
some
popish sounding things that
understand.
Yeah.
They like to. They have their own little like.
Yeah.
Little thing they do together that's a little more like pop.
Well, yeah. So you do have, I'm assuming you're most of the time during the school year, you're in school, but you do have a pretty active performance career as well, as in addition to busking at Folkline, where people might see you. Are you gigging in support of this album? Are you going out a lot?
Well, we had a CD release.
Yeah, we had a CD release at Hales Palladium, which was crazy. It was completely sold out.
It's probably the best show we've ever done.
It was insane. Right. We did not expect that to happen.
And then we played another CD release in Portland, which was crazy.
We had a whole tour lined up, or four-stop tour, but some of the other shows fell through. So we're going to do some... As we go down to one of our fiddle camps in this late summer, we might do a tour down the coast to all the way to Santa Cruz. But, you know, we just love making music, so wherever we go.
All three of you have mentioned your parents are involved in music, and there is a pretty active both folk, bluegrass, and old-timey community. I guess that's plural. All three of those communities are very active. Are there a lot of people your age involved playing music? Because you mentioned death metal, Leo, but, you know, a lot of kids your age might not be playing the kind of music that you play, or maybe even listening to it.
Well, I think that's like one of the reasons we love going to fiddle camps so much, is that we see like there are a bunch of people there that love the same kind of music we do, and there are a lot of people our age, so it's like we're like really good friends with them, but then also we can play really good music with them, kind of.
Yeah, definitely more and more there's people who are coming up and young people who are really getting into the music, which is really cool.
I think the West Coast has like a budding
does it
scene of music that's about to explode.
That's what Daryl S. Anger said about our album.
It was about to explode.
Not that.
He's a little more eloquent than that. Sorry.
Well, so when in these musical worlds, in your sort of the day job, the one at the jazz band and the classical music, do the folks that you play with at school know what you do in your off time? And have they ever asked to hear that music? And you know, have you snuck that mandolin into the A orchestra?
One day I was at school and a senior came up to me and was like, who did the design for your album? And I was like, oh, how did she find out about that?
So you were surprised that they even knew that you had one.
Yeah, but I think that people know. Like, there was an article about us in the school paper, and so it's not like we don't try to keep it hush hush.
I think like a lot of my friends are supportive of it, and like their friends too, and they came to our release and stuff. So I think some people know me as the fiddle girl, and Riley is the fiddle guy, and Leo is the.
No, I don't have a nickname. It's fine.
So after this summer and all the camps that you're going to do and folk life is over, and maybe even after high school, what do you imagine for yourselves musically? How long will this band, for example, stay together, do you think?
I don't know.
Well, I think we'll stay steady until we have to go to college, probably.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll always like
we're always going to be collaborating. Like, I think it's more important to just like be able to play music together. Maybe not as the onlys. Like, when we get into our 20s, we might not still be under that name, but we're going to be like playing together and playing, collaborating, and making music with friends. And I think that's the most important thing.
Do you see it, for each of you individually, that music is what you're going to be doing in life?
Definitely.
I mean, we'll definitely, whether sometime like the music business forces us to have a pizza delivery job or a professor job, we'll always be playing music.
Yeah.
But I hope to like be able to do it at some point as a career. I think that music is one of the most valuable and precious things. Like,
so we heard a tune to open up, a tune that you wrote together, and you're going to end this with a very traditional, I think, is it a Cape Breton piece? No,
it's Métis, which is a part of Canada. Canada has a bunch of different fiddle styles, but it's kind of more old-timey and the little bit it has influences. So. Mm-hmm.
And this is it's a tune called Gray Owl, and this is actually the first cut on this new album, which is called Setting Out to Sea. The group is called The Onlys, and they are Sammy Brayman, Leo Shannon, Riley Calcagno, and I thank you so much for coming in today. And look for them. Will you be busking, or are you actually on a stage?
Yeah, well, we're going to be on the Northwest Court stage on Friday.
Friday night.
Friday night. I don't know.
7 or 7:30.
We should probably remember this so we can tell people, but it's sometime at around 7, so if you're just sitting there, sorry.
And also, Riley has a show with his dad on Saturday.
Sunday. Yeah, Sunday afternoon. It'll all be in the Folklife program.
Yeah, and I have a show with my dad on
Saturday.
Yeah. We'll get that better.
All right. Days of the week.
So look for them all over at Folklife. Thanks for coming in today and talking to me.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
1, 2, 3.
Our music segment with The Onlys was recorded in the KUOW Performance Studio by Doug Patterson, Tib Meinig, and it was produced by Amana Al-Sadi. Our show is produced by lead producer Katie Sewell with Jason Pagano. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm.
I'm Marcy Silman. Back tomorrow, Susan Orlean's going to be our guest. Looking forward to it.
All right, it's 10:59. A renewed push for the Washington State Dream Act in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from CareForce, serving greater Seattle seniors and people with chronic illness since 1999. In-home caregivers, nurses, and geriatric care managers work to help many adults remain safely in their own home. More information at careforce.com.
Students at a South African high school face hazards.
They deal with violence, they deal with crime almost every day.
But the threat's not in their school, it's on their way to school, through some lawless neighborhoods.
This is where I feel scared.
We join one student on his long walk to school that's on the world.
That's later today during KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's. It's new, cancer, critical, and emerging.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.